Good afternoon and welcome to the October afternoon panel of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is Mike Pirtle from Omaha, and I'm pleased to be here today to my right with our Chief Judge Frankie Moore of North Platte, and to my left, Judge Rico Bishop of Lincoln. We have four cases this afternoon. We will take them in the order they are listed. Because we are in this courtroom, the oral arguments are being streamed live on NETV, so we will call the case twice when we call it for purposes of the streaming, and I don't think we have any cases this afternoon that would necessarily involve sensitive information, but if there is, use first names only or something like that so we can protect those individuals. So having said that, we are ready to proceed. Our first case is Kester versus Kester. You may approach. Good afternoon, Ms. Langan. If you are ready, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Gold, Ms. Bittner. My name is Jane Langenmach, and I have the privilege today of representing Jeremy Kester in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if I have the opportunity. This is an appeal from a decree and then an amended decree that was entered by the District Court of Antelope County, Nebraska. It was a complicated case. Virtually all issues were submitted to the District Court for a decision at trial, and unfortunately, the District Court committed error and committed abuse of discretion with respect to the majority of those issues. Janae and Jeremy Kester were married in August of 1998. They were married young and married for about 14 years before the action was filed. They had four sons, and at the time of the action, Blake was 16, Christopher was 13, Alec was, I believe, 5, and Cash was 1 year. During the duration of the marriage, Mr. Kester was self-employed. He principally farmed and operated a feedlot that was on an 80-acre tract that the parties owned. Their principal assets were this 80 acres with the feedlot and a 160-acre parcel that is the Caloff Quarter, and we'll discuss that throughout the case. Mrs. Kester went to cosmetology school during the marriage, and she worked as a beautician, and she also kept books for the farm and feedlot. The divorce was filed by Mrs. Kester in July of 2012, and the parties stipulated that they would be dividing their assets and debts as of July 12th of 2012. There was a temporary stipulation entered in the case that provided that Mr. Kester would have temporary custody while the parties shared joint legal custody. But Mr. Kester was awarded physical custody of the older two sons, Blake and Chris, and the parties shared equal time with the younger two boys. And the schedule varied a little bit so that one party would have the weekend and then through either Tuesday or Wednesday, then the other party would have the rest of the week. And that continued during the pendency of the case. Also, as part of that temporary stipulation, Mr. Kester agreed to pay, and was ordered to pay, $1,400 per month as temporary support. Not designated whether that was child support or spousal support. Child support calculation attached, but it's referred to as temporary support.
Does it matter?
Well, not really, because the issue relating to that support payment is that the party stipulated that Mr. Kester would be granted a credit for those payments against the ultimate property distribution. It matters only in that the court, in its analysis, said that what Mr. Kester was requesting was a credit for amounts paid in excess of child support. And that isn't really what he asked for, and it wasn't really a child support issue. What happened was that the party stipulated to those payments with credit to be given at the end, yet when the decree was actually entered, the court refused to grant him that credit, despite the stipulation and despite the court's prior order.
On that issue, excuse me, and I realize you have several to talk about, but if I could ask you quickly on that issue, was the court's order in regard to that stipulation an effort to find good cause to not enforce the stipulation?
I guess I don't know what effort the court was making, but...
Well, was it a finding of good cause to not enforce the stipulation?
I don't believe so. Stipulations are to be enforced unless there's good cause for not doing so, but... I think if you read that paragraph of the decree and in context with the rest of the record, what Mr. Kester was actually asking for in that particular moment was a credit for other amounts he'd paid for Mrs. Kester. He paid some shop expenses, and there was a whole list of things that he had included in his proposal to be offset. Mrs. Kester asked then, or I don't know if she actually presented any evidence on it, but the discussion was that, well, she didn't get any rent on the farm equipment or those sorts of things. So the court said, I'm not going to grant you that credit, but didn't really consider or discuss that the credit should have been entered because there was a prior stipulation and order that the credit would be entered. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
But so there was no temporary child support or temporary spousal support ordered?
There was a temporary support order. That's what it was called.
So if the court construed it as a combination of those two things, ultimately the award of $475 in child support and $500 in alimony is fairly close, right? I mean, I realize there's a few dollars difference there, but somewhat close.
The temporary support order, if you construe that $1,400 as being a child support order, it's still very different from what ultimately was ordered or should be ordered with respect to child support, because on the temporary order, Mr. Kester had sole custody of two kids and joint custody of the other two kids. What the court ultimately did, and part of our appeal is what the court ultimately did, is to split these children into two homes and gave Mr. Kester physical custody of the older two, Mrs. Kester custody of the younger two. So even if you did construe it strictly as child support, it'd be very different.
There'd be a little bit of difference there. But weren't the payments made to the child support office?
They were. And they were subject to wage withholding by stipulation of the parties. That's true. Mrs. Kester acknowledges in her brief that this is a, quote, arguably even call with respect to custody. And I'm not sure that I agree with that, but I do think that what the record reflects is that the relationship between Mrs. Kester and the older two boys was incredibly fractured. I mean, she referred to them in her testimony as liars and thieves. She didn't like the way the little boys acted when the older boys were around. So although she requested custody of all four, she also testified that she would be agreeable to splitting them, and that's what the court ultimately did. There's really no way that the older two would have gone with their mother, even if that had been ordered. In fact, there was a contempt issue as well because the older boys were refusing to go and visit their mother. And the court reconciled this, I think, by simply saying, well, the older two boys are going to stay with their dad, and on a temporary basis, the little two were with their mom, and we'll leave it that way. But that isn't what the temporary order was. The temporary order was for joint custody. And so what we have now is we have a situation where two of the boys live with their dad on the farm, spend a lot of time with their dad. They're not in daycare like the little ones are. They're too old for it anyway. But, I mean, the mother works and drives an hour away. These boys live in different towns. They don't go to the same school. They have very little interaction with each other. Even under the temporary order, they had much more interaction because they had that joint custody arrangement too. And I'll acknowledge that wouldn't really work now because those boys are in school. But with splitting them, they're in different schools. And so those little boys are not growing up in the same environment as the older boys.
But they'd be in different schools anyway, wouldn't they, because of the age difference?
They'd be in an elementary school, but they'd be in school in the same town. They would be in the same activities. They'd be cheering for the same teams. You know, they'd be spending time with that side of the family. The Kester side of the family is very close, and I think there's pretty clear evidence that Mrs. Kester's side is not so close. She hasn't spoken to her brother in like 17 years, doesn't have a relationship with her dad, moved to a town where there's really no family support. The boys have been very active in farming. They raise cattle. They go to 4-H, and they're involved in all these kinds of things, but they're basically two different families now. And
if wasn't there evidence, though, that the younger boys were being negatively influenced by the older boys with respect to their relationship with the mother?
That's what the mother testified, but the boys also testified. Blake and Chris testified. They said their father does a good job with them, that he encourages them to spend time with their mom, that he doesn't talk negatively about her. The boys said, you know, there's some hostility. We can sense that. But what the record reflects is, to the extent there's abuse, it's abuse by Mrs. Kester, principally against the kids. I mean, we had a circumstance where Blake went into his room and had to call 911. There were other instances.
Well, that was because apparently he spit at his mother, right, causing her to react. And wasn't there also evidence that Blake was leaving dead birds on the grill and urinating and things and throwing them out of windows? I mean, there was clearly a problem with the relationship Blake towards his mother.
There was definitely a problem in the relationship between Blake towards his mother and from his mother towards Blake as well. And it's not just Blake. I mean, Christopher, the second oldest, testified as well, and he said, you know, Mom hits Alec all the time, slaps him and hits him, and that's one of the little boys that was ultimately awarded to Mrs. Kester.
So isn't the court, having observed the witnesses and heard all of this, Where's the abuse of discretion there, then?
Because public policy favors keeping kids together unless there's a really good reason not to do so. And in this case, there isn't a really good reason to separate those kids. Mrs. Kester could still have parenting time. Under the parenting plan as it exists right now, it says that the non-custodial parent has every other weekend. The non-custodial parent has Halloween. I don't think the parties are implementing it that way, but technically, the way it's worded, you know, the mother would have 4th of July with the little boys, and the father would have the 4th of July with the older boys because they're the non-custodial parent.
Is the parenting plan at issue here, though?
Well, custody is at issue, which puts all of this at issue, and depending on what you do with custody, I think that will affect the parenting plan, yes.
Can you just take a few seconds to talk about the Kalhoff property? Yes. and the impact on income? Is the only evidence in the record your client's testimony about what that would mean in terms of lost income?
I believe the only evidence in the record with respect to the Kalhoff quarter is the loss of income is Mr. Kester's testimony. And Mr. Kester's proposed division of assets and debts would have him receiving that property subject to the debt, and then there would be an equalization payment. But it became clear throughout the course that he was probably going to have to sell that. And in fact, the court asked the question, won't that cause a reduction in your income? And he said, yeah, I think it will. I think it'll cause a reduction of $10,000 to $15,000 a year. Now, Jared Behringer, who's an accountant, had testified earlier about how Mr. Kester's tax returns would be adjusted for depreciation. The court made a finding that it didn't think that the tax returns accurately reflected the income, which is typical of self-employed people, and that's why you have to go through and adjust for... See that I'm out of time. That's why you have to go and adjust for depreciation, and Mr. Behringer did that. Adjusting for depreciation, though, is a different thing than adding personal expenses and failing to account for the sale of the Kalhoff quarter.
Okay. If you want to reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal.
I will submit it on the brief with that, Your Honors. I do ask you to consider that the district court decision should be reversed. I didn't get to talk about the marital estate, but that's all brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
The overriding theme in this case is the what the judge came out and said in his order, which is an overriding theme throughout the order as well, is the credibility of Mr. Kester, or the lack of credibility of Mr. Kester, and the court's ability to observe all the witnesses, including Mr. Kester's testimony, and simply didn't find him credible. A large portion of this case was the custody issue. As Ms. Mock said, there were four kids, but it really was, the age difference was 8 years between the two oldest and the two youngest. So it really was like, even when they lived together, almost two different households, with kids going in different directions. Even if they'd stayed in the same household, to pick up on your question to opposing counsel, it would be two different schools. Even if they were still together, it's a consolidated school district. The high school's in one town, elementary school's in a different town.
Could you address the temporary stipulation and why the trial court should not have enforced that?
Yes, as best I can. I was not trial counsel at the time. The temporary stipulation was entered into. I came in after that. That stipulation should not be enforced, I believe, because I think the court said it plainly in its order that it gave solid reasons for why it would be unfair for Ms. Kester to have to pay back that amount of money. Because at the time, the temporary stipulation, as I understand it, was entered into, it truly was thought to be maybe a six-month maximum period, and this case would be resolved. It'd be a trial, and they'd be done. They did not anticipate this would go on for 2 years.
Was there testimony to that effect?
Yes. My recollection is yes, without having the bill of exceptions right here in front of me to quote you.
And were both parties represented by counsel at that time when the stipulation was entered in?
Mr. Kester had the same counsel throughout, is my recollection, and then I was the second attorney to come in after that. There was a question about, does it matter how the temporary support was designated? I think that answer is no, it doesn't matter. I picked up as well with Judge Bishop that the amount is almost equal now as it was before what he was paying. It was wage withholding, and it did go through the Child Support Payment Center. I had the same question myself when I read it. I'd never seen a temporary order worded that way before. First of all, where one party would pay it back or even credit it off of any settlement. but two, it wasn't designated either alimony or temporary child support. So that was new to me to see that language. My understanding was it shouldn't matter. It's still support to her to use in the household, which she used for the children.
Because she wasn't otherwise getting any child support,
correct,
anything marked as child support.
Correct. Yeah. Nothing.
I take it there was no evidence about how those temporary supports were treated from an income tax purpose either?
No. And there was a lot of, to pick up on a couple of your questions to opposing counsel, there was a lot of animosity in this case. Prior to the separation, the relationship with the children and their mother was fantastic. There were no issues. She was the kind of the typical traditional doting mother. She did work a little bit outside of the home as a beautician or doing some book work. She helped on the farm, but she would manage the children basically in the household. And then the father worked full-time, doing a good job at what he did. And the relationship was really strong. It was only after the father had the two older boys primarily under his care that their attitude changed towards their mother. And it was, as you referenced, vulgarity, total animosity, disrespect, encouraging the little boys to not listen to the mother. The 911 call was referenced. We brought the deputy in that investigated it and had him testify, which you can see in the record. That would never happen. I mean, he looked for the strangle marks, which the kid alleged happened. Didn't happen. So the judge heard all of that testimony. It did arise from him spitting in her face. She did react poorly. She slapped him. That is true. He then retreats to the bathroom and calls 911 and says he's being abused. Cop shows up. She's forthright, was honest with him. Yes, he spit in my face. He called me an extremely vulgar word. I lost it. I slapped him. I didn't strangle him. It was one slap and that was it. The officer testified at the trial and the judge had the ability to observe him and weigh his credibility as well. The young man testified too, the two boys. Mr. Kester put the two older boys on the stand and had them testify. Well, but there were other incidents of not showing up with bags for a week-long visitation. The whole thing was impossible to deal with in her standpoint in terms of trying to get the boys just to cooperate for a weekend visitation. And it was a nightmare for her. They wouldn't bring their bags. One time she had to wash their baseball clothes and they wore their baseball clothes for the weekend. Or she gave them her own shorts to wear during the weekend because they wouldn't bring clothes. Mr. Kester would testify, well, I asked the boys and they told me their bags were packed. And he just takes their word for it, is what he said, as opposed to checking and looking into it, and which the guardian ad litem also investigated and asked him about it as well and testified about that incident. There are other incidents where she would ask to have the little boys for a Valentine's Day party at their school and the father would deny. I mean, it was just a constant battle in terms of cooperating, not only in a joint custody relationship where he would ultimately want cooperation, but even in a split custody relationship, trying to get any sort of cooperation from him was very
difficult. And your client is okay with the way the custody determination came down?
She is. Unfortunately, it breaks her heart to say that. She wanted custody of all four children. We approached the trial as judge. We would love to have the custody of all four boys, but being realistic, it would be very, very difficult for that to happen because of the attitude the two older boys had towards their mother. And so she resigned herself to the split custody. So we pitched it to the court in both ways. We'd love to have all four, but in the alternative, we'll take the bottom two, essentially, hopefully to save them, so to speak, so they're not influenced as much by their two older siblings and ultimately their father in terms of how they treated their mother. So it was difficult for her, but that's how we proposed it to the court.
Was the guardian ad litem's involvement and testimony given too much weight by the district court?
No, it wasn't.
What is the standard on that? What is the trial court standard for handling the evidence presented by the guardian ad litem?
He's treated just like any other witness. He did not offer any opinion. He was the sole role, and it was stipulated at the beginning of the trial that he would investigate, that he could testify by stipulation to his conversation with the four boys, but primarily the two older ones, the parents, and what they might have told him. For example, the older boys saying, well, we want to live with dad and mom is horrible and those kind of things. We knew those were coming in. We stipulated to that. But he didn't offer his own opinion as to what he thought would be the best interest of the children. He didn't offer his opinion as to what he thought the court should do. He had a report. The report didn't get into evidence. He just testified to his investigation, who he talked to. Now, they reference in their brief, the other side does, that he spoke more to the mother than he did the father. Well, the father had the benefit, or the guardian ad litem had the benefit, of 110 to 120 affidavits submitted on behalf of the father, and those affidavits were prepared all the way back at the time of the temporary hearing. Had the temporary hearing.
And all of those were allowed in without objection, or were there objections?
The affidavits themselves did not come in.
Okay.
But the guardian ad litem testified to having reviewed the affidavits.
Okay.
In addition to talking to any witness he wanted to talk to. But he had almost 120 affidavits just from the father's camp. And so for their argument to say that it was slanted or some way biased, we disagree. I mean, yeah, he might have met with Ms. Kesser on a few more occasions, but they worked in the same town. It was easier for her to stop by and visit with him if she wanted to. And some of that was at my recommendation. If she'd call and had a concern, I'd say, you need to talk to the guardian ad litem. He's doing the investigation. Tell him your thoughts, and he can do what he wants.
Can you speak to the argument that the court erred in not considering just the tax returns for purposes of determining the father's income for child support?
Yes. My biggest thing is regarding the whole financial realm was he just simply wasn't credible. His numbers, he wasn't believable when he testified. He would change his testimony according to the court's order. You see that. And the court comes out in paragraph 8 of the decree and comes right out and says he was not credible, he's not believable. The tax returns were one thing. His accountant was his brother-in-law. His banker was his uncle. They both testified. We had an expert come in and go through the tax returns. We hired an independent expert out of Omaha that came in and testified, went through all the tax returns and all the QuickBooks that were used for purposes of running the business, and went through and took out certain expenses. I mean, they lived well for the income they made, which is another reason the court didn't believe him in terms of his true income.
But they borrowed a lot of money over the years as well.
They did borrow a lot of money. That is true. They did borrow a lot of money. Well, we even asked him on it when he testified about his $60,000 attorney's fees at the time of trial, which I asked him about. And he testified that, well, I paid that without any assistance. I asked him, did you use any of the loan money that we'd have to go to hearings just for her to sign notes for him to operate? And he didn't use that. I said, did you borrow money from your dad or your uncle? He didn't do that. He just paid it out of his, as he says, his $1,200 gross income a month. And that's how he paid his attorney's fees. So the underlying theme is he wasn't credible and the judge didn't buy his testimony. Best to have that.
Thank you.
Observe.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. How much time does appellant have left on rebuttal?
None.
Zero. Thank you. Thank you both for being here.
He just wants to keep rubbing it in.
Your case is submitted and you are excused.